Good evening, everyone. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. A special welcome to Dr. Rajesh Tandon. Welcome to you, colleagues and students. This is the fifth Vice Chancellor's Open Lecture this year. Welcome to you for that. That series is designed to choose particularly international speakers and give them a platform at the university, also open to the public. Of course, we advertise the lectures to address issues that, or to exemplify the university's role as a thought leader in public and in pedagogy and in research and in higher education, by choosing thought leaders from around the world to come and share their experience and insights with us. One of the more specific goals that UCT has in positioning itself in the higher education landscape is as a university that is having a social impact, a university that is trying to change society in various ways through the research we do, through influencing policy, through the direct interaction of students with the communities around us, through extending our teaching activities into those communities. So in various ways, engaging, and as those of you, I think most of you are part of the UCT, will know, we recently, about 2 years ago, reconceptualized to some extent our social responsiveness policy in the language of engaged scholarship. So we have these three pillars of our core activities: research, teaching, and engaged scholarship, the third. And so engaged scholarship is about, in some ways, how do we not be an ivory tower university? What is it to challenge that that label, that accusation often, because it's usually used pejoratively? And our engaged scholarship theme is trying to do that through all of those dimensions that I mentioned, and especially through thinking about how teaching and research, our core business in a way, can engage with the communities around us, those right close to us and those farther afield in the continent. And so the speaker we have today, Dr. Rajesh Tandon, is one of the leading thinkers in the world exactly around this issue. His topic is knowledge democracy, reclaiming voice for all. I think we can agree that one of the catchwords, one of the themes of universities and economies in the 21st century is the idea of knowledge economies, the idea that the growth of the economy is much more dependent on managing knowledge, developing knowledge, than it was ever in the past. It's not anymore a natural resource economy or a manufacturing economy. It's a distinct stage or phase of development. And so we talk about knowledge economy, and the question is there something parallel to that that might be called knowledge democracy? And how does knowledge economy, as it's driven particularly by universities as the drivers par excellence of knowledge economies, how does that relate to knowledge democracy? We increasingly see universities interested in intellectual property and in protecting that intellectual property. The government revised the Intellectual Property Act just a couple of years ago, and we've had to put in a whole infrastructure to manage intellectual property and to protect it, and in some ways to privatize it instead of having it available in the ways that in the past we felt it could be. But at the same time as we have that trend to privatize knowledge and to protect it, we also have the opposite trend, which is open access, where both the large research funders and the global trends of libraries is to make not only your publications freely available so that you don't have to pay, you don't have to subscribe, it's not only in journals, it's on the web, but also the data even. We're moving towards a stage where funders of large research will require even that the data you've used is publicly available after a certain amount of time. And we're very proud that just about a month ago, we launched OpenUCT in the library. Those of you who haven't yet been to the website should go to see it. It's assessed by visitors to UCT to be one of the best in the world at the moment of repositories for digital material, and particularly theses, books, research papers, and moving towards data and comments. So we have these two trends, and then there are other aspects of knowledge democracy. It's not just about the products of knowledge and what is done with them and how accessible or inaccessible they are, but also with the production of knowledge and the extent to which the production of knowledge is controlled by the hegemony of a powerful intellectual class in universities versus the extent to which it is generated in partnership with communities who are often the subjects of that research, or people who are the subject of the research. And in that sense, to what extent we can give voice to community partners. And how do we do that in ways that are not contrived, that are genuine, and that are relevant? So our speaker tonight, I'm honored to welcome Dr. Rajesh Tandon, who is the co-director of the co-chair of the UNESCO Chair in Community-Based Research and Social Responsibility in Higher Education. About 32 years ago, he established an organization called PRIA, P-R-I-A, which stands for Participatory Research in Asia. And it's an international center for learning and promotion of citizen participation and democratic governance. And it has its head office in New Delhi, in India, where Dr. Tandon is based. Under his leadership over the last 32 years, PRIA has been working towards empowering the poor and marginalized communities collectively to claim their rights and organize for self-reliant development, drawing on the resources of higher education and research. He is described as an internationally acclaimed leader as well as a pioneer in innovative methodologies of doing participatory research, participatory planning, monitoring, and evaluation. Over the past 35 years, he's been guiding governing boards of numerous national and international civil society organizations, such as the UNDP, the United Nations Development Programme, the World Bank, United Nations Children's Fund, UN Volunteers, World Health Organization, and ILO. He was also invited to lead the Citizens and Governance Programme of the Commonwealth Foundation in the early 2000s. He served on several committees of the Government of India, and most recently, the task force of the Planning Commission preparing the 12th five-year plan for India. In addition, he is well published. He's the co-editor of the Global University Network for Innovation report, which is entitled Engagement, Knowledge, and Higher Education: Rethinking Social Responsibility, published this year. The University of Victoria in Canada awarded him a Doctor of Laws, honorary Doctor of Laws, in 2008 in recognition of his pioneering work in community-based research. He's authored and co-authored several and edited several other books, and some of these are the following: Globalizing Citizens, Civil Society and Governance, Reviving Democracy, and Voluntary Action, Civil Society and the State. So as you can see, we have a very distinguished, world-renowned academic and figure to share with us his insights, his lifelong insights in this area of engaged scholarship and democratizing knowledge. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Tandon to this podium.
Good evening. Thank you, Dr. Price, for that very warm welcome. Thank you, DVC, for transformation, and Judy Favish for inviting me to be with you in UCT this week. I am indeed very delighted to be able to spend this week here and have conversations with colleagues who are similarly concerned about the questions of knowledge and its relevance in society today. When Judy suggested that I give this lecture, as we all feel tempted to prepare a PowerPoint. Generally, my experience is that such pre-prepared PowerPoints are largely pointless and powerless. But you feel victim because you have prepared it, you're stuck here, and it has a few slides which you somehow will have to run through. And why it is so is because in the course of last 2 days, I have discovered many significant aspects of the work that is going on in engaged scholarship, in social responsiveness, in UCT as well as in the region of Western Cape, that some of the themes or concerns I bring to you may appear mundane from your experience and work. There is a section of my presentation which I mercifully did not put in a PPT slide, and which I hope to spend a bit more time on towards the end, and that has to do with the role of universities. And I'm particularly concerned about that question myself because, as the Vice Chancellor said, there is a lot of ambiguity and ambivalence around what universities represent and what they could possibly be. He referred to a book that we co-edited, and several of you in the audience were in a conference last May that GUNI, Global University Network for Innovation, organized on this theme. And the deliberations of that conference, the papers presented there, and quite a bit of work done in advance resulted in a book which some of you have seen. I checked with Judy whether I can show this book, because on Thursday we are supposed to launch it in Stellenbosch University. Some of you may not be there, and this is the first global compilation of practices in engaged work with knowledge and linking engagement, knowledge, and higher education as a contribution to drive social change, social transformation in the coming decade. So I feel very, very humble when I see the range of stories and experiences described here from around the world in terms of the work that I have been associated with or working on. And as we have taken this book and its stories to other parts of the world in this new role that I have as UNESCO chair, I have discovered that the questions and concerns are increasingly universal. The manifestation may be contextual or particular, but the questions and concerns are pretty much universal around the world. Let me start by sharing with you what I see as some of the pressing dilemmas for humanity as we live our lives today. We are living in an era of incredible prosperity. In the last 50 years, per capita incomes have grown remarkably. There are facilities available to humankind today which were unthinkable even in our parents' generation. However, in the midst of this prosperity, we continue to have structurally embedded poverty. Nearly a fifth of humanity is living under $1.25 a day, 1.2 billion people. And you would ask that all the tools, knowledge, and wealth that is available, why is it that it is not able to address this entrenched structural poverty? There is plenty in the world today. There's plenty of food, there's plenty of clothing, there is the people who are moving towards a high protein diet. There are pardon my, I read something about this in newspaper yesterday. And there are many others who are undernourished. 40% of the children of the world are malnourished. Scarcity in terms of access to safe drinking water, sanitation. The irony is the country I come from, in India, 800 million people have access to mobile, but only 400 million people have access to toilets. And you seem to wonder, mobiles can't solve your existential requirements, no? We have been fed a concept of improvement in our standards of living driven by what is called growth. And that is typically measured, economists here would tell us more precisely, in GDP terms. And in recent years, the Chinese have intimidated the rest of the world by demonstrating double-digit GDP growth for 20 years at a stretch. So when this morning I read that South African GDP will grow only 1.8%, only is written in capital. And there are sort of people saying this is deceleration. You know, so our concept of acceleration and deceleration in economic growth is measured in this way. And at the same time, we forget that you can't walk in Beijing anymore without masks. The sunshine has disappeared on the skies of Beijing. It is so polluted. There are parts of the world which are at one point in time industrial hubs and are today deserts because even shrubs don't grow with the polluted water that is left behind. And it is almost like we are living in a world where if as countries, as regions, and increasingly as cities, if we don't demonstrate a rapid rate of growth, we are somehow either not doing right things or our policies are not correct, our institutions are not doing the right thing. And it almost implies what I call TINA factor. TINA stands for there is no alternative. So we are condemned to grow perpetually. We also are living in an age where enormous concentrations of power, including militaristic power, are falling flat in the face of widespread sense of insecurity, conflict, and violence. There is no region of the world, there is no country of the world where violence is not increasingly manifested. The irony, in fact, is that more democratic the country in electoral democracy sense, more its own government shoots its citizens down, the latest being Ferguson in US. And it is around the world. Last week, if you hear the 2 years ago, the Tiananmen story in Beijing, those people were gunned down, given capital punishment. The question is that if democracy is a form of governance that we all enjoy, why is it that the original exporters of democracy, Europe and North America, in recent history, for the last 200-300 years, they have been exporting democracy, that in those countries, in those societies, young people have been occupying everywhere. The Occupy movement all around Europe and North America is a manifestation of the disconnect between so-called institutions of democracy and ordinary citizens in their daily life. So in a way, we are, as a world, as a humanity, on the threshold of enjoying unprecedented luxuries and pleasures of life. And yet we are living in a world where there are enormous tensions, contradictions, and deprivations. And it is at this juncture that really the question of knowledge for what, whose knowledge, those questions I want to situate in this context. The Vice Chancellor made a very important reference in his introductory comments to the race towards knowledge economy. And this race actually is, you know, it's amazing how this race is something that we have all bought into. And we have bought into as if this is the only race in town, you know. You know, it's how. Now, World Bank in 1999 proclaimed that if you are not a knowledge economy, then you are not advanced economy. Its statement is, all advanced economies of the 21st century are knowledge economies. It's a new form of advancement. The previous form was when Roosevelt declared that America would develop the rest of the world, and official development assistance started in 1945. Now that has declined of late, so now advancement is determined according to the knowledge economy. Growing knowledge economies, both in hardware and software terms. We have knowledge industries, we have, of course, also knowledge workers, and we have knowledge elites. Knowledge workers are in a university are postgraduate research assistants, and knowledge elites are those in whose name the book is published. We have competition now in knowledge production. And that is a phenomenon of last 25, 30 years in many of our countries. Because prior to this, we were only having universities. Now business is producing knowledge. Business is not only sponsoring knowledge production, research funding. There are business-related philanthropies. Gates Foundation spends $8 to $9 billion a year on agriculture and health-related research, from HIV/AIDS to malaria, and from new seeds to old traditional herbs. Media, increasingly, is a knowledge producer. Media produces surveys of opinions, which many a times influence policymakers far more than well-researched tomes produced in academe. And civil society. If you look at issues of human rights, if you look at issues of ecological degradation, if you look at issues of violence against children and women, these issues came in public discourse, not because universities had done some research on them, but because civil society had worked on these issues and brought to light these kinds of problematics and some knowledge around them. We seem to be living also in a society these days where many have called information society. Last week, I received a brochure from a builder who said that they are building such a high-rise living arrangement where from my car I can press a button and chicken in the oven will start cooking. I'm going to ask him who will place the chicken there. Because the power of knowledge. When I was a child, and I'm sure perhaps true for many of you as well, our grandparents, grandmothers, grandfathers, they looked after us as children when our parents were busy in economic life. They were teachers, farmers, working here or there or wherever. They were economically productive, but grandparents taught us brush your teeth, wash your hand, only serve as much as you can eat, don't waste food. I think these are universal grandmotherly practices. I'm sure you perhaps also, at least that. Now, children are moving from one screen to another. They are, when they arrive at home from school, they open television, they have small, gizmos of all types, and so this, when young parents look at their child and the child is sneezing, they immediately Google. And then they say, well, what to do with sneezing? When I was raising my kids and when my kid was sneezing, I asked my mom, my aunt, and I did not have the access to the technology that is available today. But it has implications. It has implications. I recently heard from the professional fixers, one of them, who sort of fixes deals with politicians and bureaucrats and all. He said, we no longer communicate on phone or email. So I said, well, how do you communicate? He says, only face to face. Because everything we do can be traced. Every form of communication on email, on Facebook, on Twitter, on mobile phone is stored, and it can come to haunt you. If you appear very liberal today, very secular today, somebody will pick up something you said when you was 18 year old and said, look, you know, you have changed your position. And of course, as the Vice Chancellor said, knowledge as a commodity. You know, gone are the days of knowledge commons, gone are the days of sharing knowledge. There is increasing pressure. And this pressure is particularly, as he mentioned, on universities, because there is a pressure to mobilize your own resources and patenting. In fact, I'm told in US universities, if you're a tenured professor and if you have less than 100 patents in your name, you are considered as B grade. You know, you're not quite the right quality. So what happens then? Then you have property classes and property-less masses when it comes to knowledge as a commodity. And it creates the divide, the haves and the have-nots of knowledge. And it creates, therefore, control over knowledge in ways that is not just power, but it also converts into wealth. It is therefore very interesting and equally challenging, as the Vice Chancellor said, that the open access movement is gaining momentum as well. Now, how do we deal with this race towards knowledge economy? Because it privatizes knowledge in the hands of those who have got the patent. And typically, it creates a property class and a property-less mass when it comes to the knowledge. I think it's increasingly, therefore, important to recognize the asymmetries in knowledge politics. And these asymmetries are increasingly being reinforced through the developments which are part of the knowledge economy, which are part of, you know, the new society that we have, information society that we have become part of. Global soft power, media, advertisement, and not to forget Bollywood. Bollywood exports more soft power from India than anything else we do. Of course, IT companies claim they bring billions of dollars worth of business, but they don't change the minds of people. Bollywood does. So in Western Canada, in Vancouver, the Chinese community is now learning Bollywood songs and dance as preparation for weddings in their families, which used to be an Indian expertise 20 years ago. So you can, but the global soft power is also concentrated. We don't hear about, you perhaps don't hear about All India Radio as much as you hear about BBC or CNN. And if it doesn't appear on BBC or CNN, it doesn't make news. I am sitting in a guest house here, and I try to see BBC. And what BBC shows is the description of the world as it is. So BBC's program on Africa defines my understanding of Africa. We have educational inequities, particularly in terms of access to post-secondary education. I call it primary primary literates abound, because primary education is now reaching almost universal access. So lots of people are becoming primarily literate, but they don't have access to college. And wherever access to college is increased, as we were discussing this morning, there is also question about whether these new entrants to universities and colleges are prepared or equipped to have this access. Do they know the tools of learning as universities demand if they have to be accepted as students? Widespread digital penetration, but there is also a digital divide. A classic divide is between mobile and internet. If I take the case of India, about 78% of the population has access to mobile, and I think the figures in Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, are also pretty much similar. But only 17% of Indians have access to internet. So what does it do? You have deep oral penetration. Mobile is all about people can speak and listen, but those who write are fewer. Now, the word, spoken word, doesn't go that far, and that's why people learn how to write. In the olden days, we used to write letters in a postcard. Because we couldn't speak. Nowadays, if you use mobile, if I call my home, it'll cost me more. Thankfully, we have Skype. And finally, the language hegemony. I call it victorious English. And it's a good language. It's a language which gives access to global information, connects us globally in today's time. All young people in all societies are rapidly learning English. But is it being done in a manner in which we are denying or devaluing our own mother tongues, our own languages? Because at a very fast pace, languages are dying. And with dying languages, concepts, worldviews are also dying. Because languages depict a worldview. So English language is spoken by a scheduled caste young person in India whose parents do not know that language may create a rootlessness where you are conceiving yourself to be part of the global, but without roots on the ground, without feet on the ground. And that tension is palpably here today. There is a rush towards learning and acquiring English language, which is done as if our mother tongues were inferior. And that's the problem. Learning five languages, no problem at all. It gives you a richness which is important, but not at the denial of your own. So I am coming to this question of rebuilding knowledge society, and knowledge democracy is a part of that conversation. How do we do that? Valuing diversity of knowledge sources. And a very interesting proposition came finally, in the UNESCO Declaration of 2009 in the second Higher Education Conference, where it acknowledged for the first time that indigenous knowledge and experiential knowledge is as relevant to our understanding of the world as knowledge produced in academic and lab situations. Plurality of knowledge forms. And this, I can only give you the example of, beyond the written word, example of what has come to be known as holistic health and healing in health. You know, the modern medicine first was promoted by delegitimizing and almost calling it, you know, traditional practices, herbal practices, using local herbs and local healing practices. They were labeled 30, 40, 50 years ago as voodoo science, you know, some spiritual gymnastics that people were doing. Now, voodoo science is most popular in California. There are more holistic health and healing centers in Silicon Valley than they are left in India. Of course, Indians are chasing injections, and Americans in Silicon Valley are meditating. But, you know, those, like the Vice Chancellor, those of you who have been involved in public health always looked at human health as a combination of your anatomy as well as your, you know, it's just not body, it was my body, mind, and soul, so to speak. Now, since mind and soul were disconnected from the body in the previous science, now they're trying to reconnect through meditation. I want to suggest to you that critical thinking is a natural human phenomenon. Only some of us get PhDs. But getting a PhD is not certification of a critical thinking competence. If you accept that critical thinking is a natural human phenomenon, even those who didn't go to school actually think very critically about their agriculture, about their children, about their family, and sometimes those who have got double PhDs, including the honorary one like me, do very stupid things uncritically. So, in a way, if we are talking about knowledge society, then we have to treat everybody as an expert, irrespective of their academic certification. It does not mean that everybody is expert on the same type, they're expert on the same quality, they're expert for the same kinds of knowledge, but everybody has capacity to think critically and use their experience as a body of knowledge. And finally, knowledge as a global public good, the whole question of knowledge commons, and it's beyond consumption of knowledge. And the knowledge commons question is particularly important because it depends on our worldview, again, on how we treat commons. We all are aware what happened to natural resource commons, the ecological commons, our indigenous people around the world, in Africa, Latin America, Asia, Western Canada, everywhere, indigenous people treated commons as a source of nourishment. Some others of us treated commons as a source of income. You exploited the commons for making some more money. And the same thing is happening to knowledge commons. In my view, knowledge commons as a public good is a source of nourishment for all humanity. And if it is allowed to be captured by a few for the purpose of exploitation and consumption, then we create this problem. Finally, in the slide is the question of how do we move towards co-construction of knowledge. And one of the problematics that I have been questioning quite a bit, given my own education and my own training historically, my first degree is electronics engineering, my second degree is an MBA, a PhD in organizational science. Heavy duty academic qualification I have. But it has many a times created a disconnect in me between my cognitive self and my emotive self. I think, I feel, and I act many a times are in dissonance. Instrumental nationality has been the dominant epistemology in last 200-300 years. As a result, it has treated all social and human phenomena as a reason for control. Other than cognition, I believe the aspect of human living called feeling is a source of knowing, just as action is a source of knowing. Action research did get some credibility for a while, but instrumental rationality continues to dominate. And that is why certain sections of society always fail intelligence tests, because intelligence tests are entirely cognitive. Those who do very well in intelligence tests are called genius. They fail emotional quotient because they don't know how to sing and dance. The ones who know how to sing and dance don't do well on intelligence test. And then we proclaim that the genius is the one who does well in intelligence test. If you score above 125, 130 in IQ test, you are a genius. And if you score below 75 or 50, you are a moron. The moron is the quintessential musician and singer of the world. And the genius ends up creating the nuclear bomb. I think one of the challenges of co-construction of knowledge is sharing control over means of production and dissemination of knowledge. How do we engage others who are outside the research enterprise, community actors, indigenous leaders, so-called lay people, in producing knowledge collaboratively, but also in sharing the fruits of that knowledge. For most of my life, I have seen that communities' interest in knowledge production is to improve their life. A scholar's interest in knowledge production is to publish. The two are not contradictory. It is possible to do both, provided we pay attention to the legitimacy of communities' interest in using knowledge towards its improvement. That is as legitimate a goal of knowledge production as it is for publishing. Listening to differences and engaging with respect is an essential prerequisite for knowledge production in a mode of co-construction. Now, before I stop, because time is running out, let me just say two, three things about the role of universities. And I discovered yesterday about your four strategic initiatives, Dr. Price. You know, poverty and inequality, development and sustainability, you know, safety and violence, and you know, reinvigorating the schools, education system. Now, if you look at these four strategic formulations, these four are a reflection of the challenges South African society faces today. However, our work in universities is organized around disciplines: history, political science, engineering, etc., etc. Outside universities and academia, disciplines don't exist. Opportunities and problems exist. How does this correlation between disciplinary teaching and research on the one hand and real-life problems and opportunities. How does this conversation happen? And the discourse on interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary, all this transdisciplinary, all this has been going on for 30, 40 years. It doesn't yield much. And the reason it doesn't yield is because when we design curriculum, when we teach, we are discipline bound. And that is the nature of higher education institutions like universities. Now, if you look at the sort of the mission of universities, it is called research and teaching. Research is about knowledge production, a theme I have been talking about quite extensively so far. And teaching is essentially about learning. Teaching is what teachers do, learning is what students do. Sometimes there is a disconnect. Teaching happens, learning does not necessarily happen. And it particularly is a problem for those types of students who are now entering our universities, whose parents never went to colleges and universities. They come from different socioeconomic backgrounds, they come from different sociological groupings, linguistic groupings. It wasn't a problem for me to enter a university because I had English language in my high school. And my grandfather had done his undergraduate. So going to college was seen as like getting up in the morning and brushing your teeth. It was assumed that you will go to college. But for the next generation which is coming in all our societies, that is not the case. And for them, learning will only happen if it is relevant, contextually appropriate, and meaningful. They will study a curriculum if they can find a way to link it to the habitation in which they grew up or to which they are connected, society or social setting to which they are a part of. And this is where the greatest challenge universities face today. So ultimately, universities teach that which has been accumulated over years and generations of research. So research actually produces knowledge which is then disseminated through teaching function of a university. Of course, my current research that I am doing this week may not feed into my class tomorrow morning, but the one I did 10 years ago or my predecessors in the discipline did does feed in. There is a very close connection between knowledge production and therefore the types of knowledge that is produced and used in teaching. Very close connection. And then, of course, recently many scholars talk about the third mission, which is described variously as service, et cetera, et cetera. I want to submit to you that if universities get knowledge production function right in contemporary context, they will be able to improve learning in their teaching, and that will be their most important contribution in terms of service. Service is not something that is devoid of or disconnected from the core function of research and teaching. And that's how I view engaged scholarship. For me, engaged scholarship is about co-construction of knowledge which has relevance to society, to challenges of our times, like the four strategic initiatives that the Vice Chancellor has presented to all of us in UCT. How can we co-construct that knowledge which relates to addressing those four strategic areas of concern of South African society today? And how can that knowledge then become a part of the teaching function, which if we pay attention to students' learning, will also challenge us on pedagogy. And it is this pillar on which I would like to propose that engaged scholarship rests. UNESCO in its 2009 higher education conference made a, in my view, a somewhat provocative declaration, where it said that the purpose of universities is to produce ethical citizens of the future. In historical times, last 200-300 years ago, over the colonial period in which many of our societies experienced the foundation of a modern form of university, the role of the universities was to produce and reproduce elites. And admission criteria and curriculum and manner in which, you know, the kind of hostel rooms you stayed in and etiquettes you learned, how to eat with fork and knife and all that. I don't need to tell you that. Democratization of society would require, therefore, democratization of elites, and in my view would require ethical, informed, and active citizens. And this is a role that universities have played in the past, and this is a role they can play. One of the very well-known Portuguese scholars, Sousa, de Santos de Sousa, talks about cognitive justice as a prerequisite for social justice. His argument is that if we don't respect various epistemologies and ecologies of knowledge, plurality of knowledge, knowledge forms, knowledge modes of production, if we don't respect it, we will not be able to achieve social justice, because cognitive justice is the building block of social justice. And in 5 BC, in one of the earlier universities in eastern India called Nalanda, one of the students became a teacher as well. He subsequently, he went to the university because his father said, you must prepare yourself to be the future king. He went to the university where he interacted with a large number of students and faculty, lived on residential university it was, learned things both intellectually and by hand, but did not return to be the ruler. His name was Gautam the Buddha. If Buddhas can be produced in universities in 5 BC, 500 BC, 5th century BC, then surely in 21st century AD, we can have universities play a role which produces active, informed, and ethical citizens, as UNESCO's call suggests. And I want to submit to you that that will happen if we use the perspective of knowledge democracy as the fulcrum of our engaged scholarship. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Tannen. I presume you're happy to take some questions?
Sure.
We don't necessarily, in our VC lectures, we don't always have questions and answers, but it would seem really inappropriate this particular lecture. Far be it for me to take that responsibility. So, open to the floor comments.
Yes. Can you spend a few seconds describing
what you mean by a co-construction of knowledge?
I'll just take three questions and then we'll Professor Noel is in the middle there. Is there a microphone?
Hi, thank you for that. It was very thought-provoking. One of the focus that we've had here in the post-apartheid society is to increase our sort of knowledge in the society of the sciences, mathematics, physical sciences, because that was considered to be important for the growth of our economy. And from what you say, we could be running into trouble because a lot of the young people who are coming to university to study these courses, the course content is not relevant to their lives and to their past lives. So how are we going to actually bridge that? Thank you.
Yeah, okay. Let me start with mathematics. My grandfather was a professor of mathematics, and I did reasonably well as a student. In grade 8, I had a mathematics teacher who, in the beginning of the class, at grade 8 you learn a bit of geometry, a bit of algebra, you know, some arithmetic. You don't get to differential equations at that age. That happens in 10th, 11th, 12th, sometime 12th, 11th, 12th. He asked us at the beginning of that class to find examples of shapes which interested us from our home and playfield or wherever. And different people brought, you know, some brought bottles, some brought this, some brought that. And that was the beginning of geometry. Except that there were four or five students who couldn't find anything looking like a triangle. And they had great difficulty in conceptualizing a triangle. They could see a rectangle, a square, a circle, a sphere, a pyramid and all that, but couldn't figure out what triangle was. So he introduced a game, putting three of us with string. It was a very popular game, you know, you three people and three corners and they have strings and they pull each other in different ways. And he said, look, this is what triangle is. It has three angles and three sides. Now, what was he doing? He was trying to relate mathematics in everyday life. Of course, you can't relate Boolean algebra in your life, but surely you can do binary. You can do zero and one. Yes? No. Binary? Yes? No. Electron touches? Doesn't touch. Touches become one, doesn't touch, zero. So I think the question is not use of mathematics. It's the question of pedagogy. And if mathematics is the science which helps us to understand the world, surely it must have manifestation in the world I have grown up in. It's just that I didn't look at it from the mathematics eyes. Not everybody sits down under a tree and an apple falls on their head. But various things fall. And as children, we have seen them fall. Isn't it? So, you know, I think a lot of students who come from communities where their exposure to the study of science in a modern sense has not happened. If we made the pedagogy see the relevance of phenomena like physics or mathematics have, obviously they will not be able to see quantum mechanics in their everyday life. But the foundation of physics and the foundation of mathematics is in everyday life. Why is sky blue? If you can figure that out, everybody sees the same blue color. Some ask the question and have an answer. Many don't even ask the question. And I think curiosity about learning is where we can make a difference in pedagogy. That will, you know, we have a serious problem in our society where it is being construed or summarized or concluded that tribal children, tribal indigenous children, don't do very well in science. They do very well in sports, they do very well in arts, music, dance, everything else, but they don't do very well in science. And the reason they don't do very well in science is not because they lack innate capacities to think and analyze. It's just that they don't relate the phenomenon in the same way. Entrepreneurship training for indigenous young people has always failed because they don't relate to natural resources as owners. The concept of ownership doesn't exist. Their concept is trusteeship. They live with natural environment. They live with forest, trees, water. They use some of it, but they protect it. The rest of us, non-indigenous communities, we own trees, forests, land, and water. So our relational worldview is very different. So for them to understand and take interest in science requires that pre-work of raising their curiosity. The co-construction of knowledge, I'll give you a couple of examples. One is related to this argument about what do you do with forests and water bodies. And a lot of studies were done which focused on the use of water for larger sort of societal development, you know, like irrigation or industry, as well as for drinking and family use. Now, as I was just giving this example, that if you engage them in looking at water, engage the communities which have lived around water, which have worked all their lives with water as a part of their growing up and tradition, they would look at water as they would say it's a source of life. So water is life. Water is life means when we work on how do we harvest this water, store this water, distribute this water, their approach to this will be, if we are taking so much water for this purpose, are there ways in which we are regenerating that? Regenerative concepts come in this co-construction of knowledge. Now, the other very interesting example comes from violence against women and children, because it was only in the approach that was taken to treat women as legitimate sort of thinkers and articulators of the experience of violence that constructs shifted from treating them as victims to as agents who can bring about a change. So a lot of early studies on violence against women said, well, terrible things have happened, let's look after them and, you know, do something which doesn't hurt them anymore. But later studies, when the women themselves were, they said, look, no, we have suffered violence. It doesn't mean we have become victims. You haven't examined the aspect of resistance to violence that we put up. And that was an active resistance. Yes, we got bruised and hurt, but we also resisted. And there is an argument, therefore, to look at violence that women experience from a slightly different framework. So I think the practice of co-construction will vary, but what it implies is that those of us who are in the business of doing research as a part of our professional work may want to find partners in society, in communities where we do research, where the issues may have relevance, so that we can build a body of knowledge which is, I think, enriched by different frameworks, different perspectives, and perhaps even different sets of questions. One of the biggest challenges in building this kind of a co-construction approach in practice is that typically we in universities already have the research questions. And what we are looking for is just data. But I think the framing of strategic initiatives in a way by you is putting the research questions on its head from the lens of society as opposed to lens of the discipline. And I think that's a very, and this is where I see this, you know, you have this very interesting knowledge co-op model. There are many places where mechanisms to interface community and university are being created. And I was part of one mechanism where a university was doing, it was a partly agricultural university also, and doing a lot of studies, it's master student, PhD student, doing a lot of studies, collecting data on soil, land, this, that, and the other. And but that information never went back to the community. So what they did was, just as a single small step, is they last 4 or 5 years research, they just systematized it in a simple findings, in a simple way, and university asked one of their colleagues there to take this back where the study was done, present it in a 1 hour conversation. It had a tremendous impact because prior to that, the community, the farming community around the university never saw university as something that can help them. They only looked at university as a place where some of their children may ultimately go and study, but on an ongoing basis. And when they saw the findings, many of them were very relevant to them. And then they created a process whereby the problems of farmers could occasionally become research topics for master's thesis. And the only conditionality in the communities asked for is that whatever you find, could you also tell us what you found? Because we may use it for a change. And I think that worked very well. It didn't require major investment or anything very different. It just shifted the way the research purpose was expanded to include them. The students were open and their supervisors were open to the possibility that research questions could come from farmers themselves. And not all research questions got answered. Neither all research findings were useful, but I think it opened up a relationship. And the big question, therefore, for universities is in all our societies, is to overcome this image that they are still institutions producing and reproducing the elites, in a way to overcome the divide between the society and the university. And I think by engaging in co-construction of knowledge, one can open up the possibility of demonstrating the societal relevance.
Thank you very much. Take one or two more questions if there are, and then we'll wrap up. Is anyone got one? I have a question, otherwise, if there aren't others, about your term, Victorious English. I have this image of Queen Victoria presiding over Victorious English. But I'm concerned that you dismiss the problem a bit too glibly and want to understand better what you think we should be doing, particularly from a university's point of view. Is it your view that we should be resisting the temptation to use English as the universal medium of instruction and of research, or that the world has benefited from that? Because it doesn't seem to me that we are doing that at the expense of other languages for other purposes, but we're clearly doing it at the expense of other languages for research. And do you think there's an alternative to that? Are you proposing that there is an alternative to that?
No, I don't have solutions, because as you know, I'm grown up in a multilinguistic society with lots of different language groups and all that. There are two practical problems that are coming in. The first is that if I think in English, my framework is somewhat different than when I think in my mother tongue. Now, I had to make, once I recognized it, I had to make special effort. For example, I continued in the early years to use the phrase participatory research. But when I stopped for a minute and said, if I am thinking about this phenomena or this methodology in my mother tongue, what will I call it? And I struggled. I couldn't find an equivalent. And the reason I couldn't find an equivalent was because I was not beginning to think about it. So what I ended up doing in order to understand myself what this difficulty was is to go back to read a little bit about the Brahmanical tradition. In our history, till very recently, Brahmins, upper caste, topmost in the caste hierarchy, were the only ones who could produce knowledge. And the language of knowledge production was Sanskrit. The masses were not allowed to study in Sanskrit. They didn't know Sanskrit. So the tomes of knowledge remained in Sanskrit language. And it was then that I discovered that this discrimination was designed by using language and the framing of concepts in that language in a different way. And so the first challenge is, do we have constructs of, let's say, sustainability, which are South African endogenous concept? Then whatever we call it in English is okay. But sustainability as a construct is perhaps not defined in the same way in our endogenous tradition. Though I would like to argue that 50 to 100 years ago, our societal practices were somewhat more sustainable than they are today. So this is the first difficulty that happens. The second difficulty that happens is that the highway of knowledge increasingly is crowded with English language literature. The rest of the literature is considered as gray literature. Now, it will be, it took us a lot of time in our region to engage Indonesians and Cambodians, Laos people, because they were not looking at English language as the base of their higher education till very recently. Their bhasha was the language of their research and teaching. So we did not access that, what their frameworks were, what their findings were. And as a result, if you look at Asian curriculum in any of the Indian universities, it has material from Philippines, of course, Malaysia, but very little from Indonesia, because the language was not accessible. So is there a way by which, even when we teach in English and we do research in English, we are able to use the scholarship, the literature that may be coming from indigenous languages, and therefore the stories, the frameworks, the findings that come from indigenous language? As I said, I don't have a solution, but I think we are not making enough effort. This morning I gave an example where as a new generation of students started entering, partly through affirmative action of Government of India, higher education, the scheduled caste, the lower caste students, 6-7 years ago rebelled in a class of literature because they did not find any writing of scheduled caste scholars in the curriculum. And they were all higher caste Indian poets and authors and story and novelists and all whose material was there. It almost implied to them that they had no scholarship. Now, the difficulty was that they never wrote anything other than in mother tongue. So they resisted that, and since then, a lot of curriculum redesign took place in terms of bringing that literature in, and more investment was made in adapting it to, if you are learning it in English language. So I think there is a way in which we can maintain the requirement of the modern global connectivity by use of English language, and yet be sensitive to the fact that our frameworks and concepts are language sensitive.
Thank you so much. Dr. Tannen, thank you on behalf of all of us at the University of Cape Town. And I want to just give you a small gift of our appreciation, a souvenir of the university, of our treasures, and to say on behalf of all of us, of all of you, thank you again for giving us of your time and of your insight.
Thank you very much. Thank you.